Okay. Did you, how about that text that Ted sent us? Wasn't that funny? That text he told us that we should have, what did it say? Like, no politics. No.
I'm not going to say
that, the second word. And then he said, like, stick to the news. So, like, the first thing I wanted to talk about was, like, the three Jewish candidates that we have running for Cincinnati. There's two city council candidates running, and then there is a mayoral candidate that's Jewish. The mayoral candidate, of course, you know, I love his name. It's Gavi. His name is Gavi Bechtrup. And then the two Jewish candidates from city council are Greg Landsman, and the other one is Kurt Grossman. You know, Kurt.
Yeah, but Ted is going to kill us if we start talking about that on this podcast. You know that.
Well, I mean, the other thing that, can you believe in, did you read about that Kelly Prather that was one of the candidates for mayor? And she just got charged with COVID-19 fraud. Did you see that too in the news?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God. Well, something every minute, isn't it?
Yeah. So you can't get away from the politics.
That's true.
Hi everyone. This is Julie Babs Bernson-Brook, Yehuda Basha, Bat Shlomo, V'chana Gitel HaKohen. And I learned about that HaKohen from...
Oh, HaKohen.
We're going to have this the whole time.
HaKohen.
Yeah, we're going to have this the whole time with you, Pam.
I know. Sorry.
I learned about that from Gail Levine Schindler, our food columnist, who we actually are going to give a call to today.
Oh.
So I'd also like to welcome my special guest host, Pamela Richard Sakes. Would you introduce yourself?
Yes, hello. My name is Pamela Joy Richard Sakes, but Shana the Ruvain HaKohen. So we are both descendants of Kohanes.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty nice. That's very, very nice. And I know we've already interviewed you in the past for the Israelite when you were one of our Persons of the Year, a very prestigious award that everyone next year is going to be clamoring to get.
I'm sure.
But throughout this interview today, throughout this podcast of the American Israelite, I am going to keep interviewing you and asking you questions. So this is the Let There Be Light podcast from the American Israelite. And today is Thursday, April 8th, and it is the 26th of Nisan, 5781. And on our front page, we have a great article that I was really impressed with. In fact, I called over to a friend of mine at Jewish Family Services, Beth Kotz, and I asked her if she wrote it because she used to be a writer here at The Israelite, and it's so well written. The title of it is The Shot, The Second Shot, A Transformative Moment for the Person and the Community. And it's actually talking about the statistics of COVID and how you can expect to feel after you've had the vaccination. I was particularly impressed with the section that discusses the percentiles. And, you know, I don't know about you, but what it does is it shows us what it means to be 95%. And what it means is it's not that we're 95% of the population. It means that we only have a 5% of our person to get the virus. In other words, you are less likely to get sick. It's less than, given a population of double vaccinated individuals, it is expected that about 0.049, that's less than half a percentage, will contact the coronavirus. And then it goes on to talk about what Debbie Balk and Kim Reed both talked about, their experience of getting the vaccine. What was your experience to get the vaccine?
Well, my experience was that my dear friend, Julie Brooke, called me one evening and started yelling at me on the phone. And my head was spinning and I was very confused because she's just yelling at me going, get in the car right now. Go get your purse and get in the car. And her voice is starting to escalate.
Not that I don't already have a loud voice.
That is true, as do I. So I'm like, what are you talking about? And she's like, just don't ask questions. Just get your purse, get in the car. You got to go now, go,
I also
go.
Told you to check to make sure the oven was off and if you had any electronic appliances like curling irons to
That's
turn
right.
the oven.
That's right. Well, Thank you, because I was in the middle of making dinner. Sonny's standing on the other phone talking to his mom. And I'm like, and he's looking at me because I'm running around like a chicken with my head cut up, trying to find my purse. You know, I'm like, wait, I got to put on some clothes, because I was basically in my jammies, you know, making dinner. And
it was a Friday night.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So I am running upstairs, throwing on some clothes. He's yelling up, "What's going on?" I said, "I don't really know." And then I said, "Julie, what's going on?" You said, "You're getting the vaccine. I got, you know, the guy called and he said, go now. You've got an hour." And so I run downstairs and she's screaming at me the whole time. I've got the phone up to my ears. I'm throwing on my clothes. I'm like, "Well, where do I go? What do I do?" She goes, "Just get in the car and we'll worry about it in a minute. Just get in the car." So I finally, you know, we ran into the car. I got Sonny, got the keys, started. Where am I driving? Oh, you're going to Dayton. So it's raining. It's rush hour. I'm having a nervous breakdown. But thanks to Julie, I was able to get my first vaccine shot. Sonny, who has a client, he's working at a nursing home, was able to get it a few weeks before. And I was starting to have massive vaccine envy because everybody I knew was getting it. And I was just feeling so sad. And I have to tell you, when he put that needle in my arm, I started to cry, not because it was painful at all, but because I was so relieved. I can't even tell you. And thank you, Julie, from the bottom of my heart. I know for the millionth time, I gush over her all the time, but it really made all the difference in my life. So thank you, thank you. And also, she was responsible for helping my son get his vaccination too, which enabled me just about a week ago to give him a hug for the first time in over a year. So thank you.
Thank you. And of course, you know, I loved getting you shot. how did you feel after you had the second vaccine?
Oh my God. I mean, let me just tell you that my second week after the vaccine is coming this coming Friday. But, you know, I've been doing a lot of research and, you know, you know that I was probably one of the more careful of your friends.
Very, very careful. I mean, I think Ted and I referred a few times to you.
Oh, yes. I knew exactly who you were talking about. Anyway, but I was really careful and a little bit nervous about the whole thing. I have, you know, three elderly parents. My mother-in-law is in her 80s, as are my parents. And, you know, I was just worried, you know, especially about them. So anyway, but now I felt like maybe there's got to be some reward for having gotten this vaccine. I mean, if in fact I can't go out and do a few things, go to a restaurant, you know, go to the mall, do some things I have been wanting to do, then why do we even bother getting it if I'm going to just be a recluse? So at the end of the day, I did all the research and I found out that really the percentage, like you just said, is so small. And people say to me who are still being very careful, well, what about people who haven't been vaccinated yet? And I guess my answer is that's on them. You know, certainly if they haven't been vaccinated because they couldn't get the vaccine or they were having trouble getting an appointment, I don't mean it in a negative way.
Right.
I'm just trying to say if they didn't get a vaccine because they were against it or haven't felt like they wanted to take the time, that's on them. If, you know, but I don't think I'm going to get it if I'm around someone who's not been vaccinated, right?
Right.
Okay. So that, I guess I feel like I've been freed. And at Passover, even at the Seder, that was the nature of our conversation.
I think
a lot of
people talked about that feeling at their Passover Seder. So I'm going to go over it one more time. It indicates that your vaccinated self is 95% less likely to get sick than your unvaccinated self. And that's amazing. And Debbie Balk, who works with Star Point Home Care, made a comment at the very end, and she said, "Finally, there was something I could do. I feel empowered. I feel proud. I feel connected to my community and to my country. It's the feeling you're doing the right thing for yourself and for those you love." And I think that's pretty much what you say, too. And, you know, yesterday I went for my appointment. As everyone knows, I was part of the trial vaccination for Johnson & Johnson, and they originally gave me a letter because I needed a letter to prove I'm giving a wedding shower for someone that we know and love, Kevin Sakes. And part of the invitation said that you need to be vaccinated in order to attend the shower. And I figured if everyone else has to have proof, so I called where I had my trial vaccination. I asked if I could get a proof that I've had the vaccination. And that time they emailed me a letter. But when I went yesterday for my checkup, they actually gave me a card. And I have a card like everybody else has that says I am COVID-19 vaccinated. So I'm very excited to put that in my purse, take a photocopy of it in my purse, and then also take a photograph and put that on my cell phone.
Can I just say one thing? I have to say to all the listeners out there, Julie Brooke, you are one of the bravest people I know. I feel emotional saying this, but I don't know if I've said this to you. You know, when everybody was so freaked out over COVID, you were one of the first people to step up and say, I am going to be part of this trial. And it takes a very courageous person. We didn't know anything. We were all busy washing our groceries at that time. Nobody knew much about all of this. And you, without any hesitation, stepped up and said, I'm going to do this. I mean, that's not only courageous and amazing, you did an amazing mitzvah. And I'm proud to know you. And I just want everybody to know, you know, what Julie did, not just for herself, but for everybody. And it could have turned out very differently.
Right? I had hope. I really did. From the very beginning of COVID, I really had hope that things would be okay. And for some families, they weren't okay. But right. You know, fortunately for our families, it's been okay. And we have to always think about those people that it just wasn't okay.
Right, exactly. Yeah. My dad lost his best friend and, you know, a lot of people.
Very hard.
Yes, exactly.
Speaking of which, last week was supposed to be the top doctor's medical issue, but Ted has changed it to April 15th. Publishes on April 15th, which is actually next week. And also on page 3, we have an advertisement for Matt's Bakery, and I brought in, I had bought a bunch of stuff. You know, it's free shipping one day from Columbus if you spend over $35. And so Ted and I like to join in together and get some things. And what I had done is right before Passover, I ordered a bunch of stuff and put it in my freezer for after Passover. And I have a few things for you to try. I have a chocolate chip cookie and also a piece of the banana cake.
Ted
swears by the banana cake.
Marvelous.
He says it's absolutely delicious, so I brought it. I'm going to pass it along to you real quick. I'm going to get up and send it over to you.
Did you already try it?
I tried it. It's absolutely delicious.
Oh, marvelous. All right, I'm going to take a little piece, and then you're going to take it back. Wait, don't go. Hold on.
We're across the table because even though we're both vaccinated, we're still trying to follow the rules about being socially distanced. So
aren't we the best?
We are the best. It's really moist, isn't it? That banana cake.
Oh, my God, yes.
I feel like it has maybe a little bit of coffee in it by the taste of it, just a touch of the taste.
I don't know.
And they don't use butter. It's Parv. Everything is Parv from Matt's Bakery. And
it's going to throw it.
So you don't have to worry. It's Parv. And so it doesn't have dairy. So someone who is a vegan can also eat it because, again, unless they don't eat eggs either. But it's no dairy in there.
Well, it's delicious, actually.
On page 4, we have our community calendar. And on Sunday, April 11th, it is Yom HaShoah.
Wait. Say that again.
Okay, Pam. It is Yom HaShoah.
Thank you. Last week, you and Ted with the yums, and I was thinking, I'm screaming at my phone. What are you saying, yum? Yom Kippur, yum this, yum that.
Yeah, well, they're now titling all three holidays together the yums. So
great.
And later, we are actually going to talk about what we should be baking, what Israeli foods that we should be baking in honor of the Yoms.
Thank you.
And Yom HaZikaron is Tuesday, April 13th, and Yom HaZmaut is Thursday, April 15th. Sorry, Tuesday, April 13th and Thursday, April 15th.
So Yom HaZmaut?
Yom HaZmaut.
Oh, okay. Close. Good. All righty.
Well, you know, Sabra Hummus has recalled over 2,000 containers, and I know that we in our family eat a tremendous amount of hummus.
Yes, so do we.
Tremendous. I mean, you could see it probably coming out of our eyes and our ears. We love all the brands. I have yet to find a brand that I don't love, but they've recalled over 2,000 containers. What states were they in?
Let's see. In alphabetical order, Alabama, Arizona, Arkansas, California, Florida, Indiana, Mississippi, Maine, Missouri, Nebraska, North Carolina, New Jersey, Utah, Virginia, Washington, and Wisconsin.
Okay. So it's not Ohio. So those of us in Ohio, I guess, are safe. Because yes. I actually very carefully checked ours. It looks okay. And Ted is still looking for an assistant editor. So anyone out there that would like to write for the American Israelite, Ted is looking for an assistant editor.
Must know how to use a computer and the internet. Okay. That's a tough one. Must be able to type and spell efficiently. Well, that would be a first, Ted, for the Israelite.
Yeah, we have a major typo in today's that we are going to apologize profusely for. And be aware the position is only part-time.
Okay.
And I can tell you after working here, being fired, working here, being fired, working here, being fired, working here, being fired, and then asked to come back. Yes.
Is that what he means by part-time?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
And you'll notice on page 9, it says, what will Julia and Pam talk about? Find out on this week's podcast, which we hope, you know, will arrive shortly into your very favorite podcast platform or on our website. You were thrilled with the photograph.
Oh, let me tell you. Let me just tell you. I was like, wait, I worked hard to lose weight, and now it looks like I put on 40 pounds from this picture. What is going on? Both of us.
Well, it swells with the ink.
I see. Is that what it is?
It swells
it's
with
fattening
the ink.
Ink or something?
It swells with the
okay,
ink.
Okay, yes. It's definitely a stretched out version, but okay. I mean, what are you going to do?
You know, and Pam, I want to again tell everyone that you are responsible for that Let There Be Light logo. It was you and your company, Be Bold Creative.
Well, sort of, yes. And then Ted kind of went in and did some stuff to it. So
he fixed.
I mean, maybe I don't want to completely take
100%.
Yeah, for a few different reasons. But I think Ted did his thing to it. But
so
yes.
Before you worked for Be Bold Creative, you were with the Meyerson Foundation. Did I pronounce it?
Oh, my
it?
God, you did. I'm so proud. She used to call it the Meyerson. Everyone says Meyerson.
Yeah.
And I say, well, wait a minute. Is it like February, March, April, May? And they're like, no. And I'm like, well, Meyerson is spelled M-A-Y just like the month. So why does everybody say it's not just you? Everyone says Meyerson.
Yeah, I know.
I don't get it.
I don't know. Not only do we have spelling errors at the Israelite in the Let There Be Light podcast, we also have, you know, verbal errors. So,
okay.
And prior to you working at the Meyerson.
See, she almost did it again.
The Meyerson Foundation. Mm-hmm. I heard about you before you even moved to Cincinnati from my mother. She talked about the fact that you had won an award for decorating your children's playroom. Am I correct with that story?
Yeah, so at the time there was two parenting magazines. One was called Parents and one was called Child Magazine. This was way back in the day, and they had a contest every year for the best children's play space. So I entered the contest because I had designed our basement in Highland Park. I had turned it into I had worked as the marketing director for the Philadelphia's Children's Museum. And so I got a lot of inspiration from that, and I, you know, redid my basement for the kids. And so I decided to submit it to the magazine, and I was one of the, I think, three winners.
What did it look like? Describe the basement to us.
Oh, my God. It had all different sections. There was one that was like the art section where I did big black and white tiles on the floor so in case it got wet or messy, we could clean it up. And it had like a special sink, and it had everything you could, water tables and all kinds of stuff there. And then there was a big costume area with unbreakable full-length mirrors and a little stage so the kids could get up and put on plays in the different costumes. And there was, like, the climbing area. There was an area where I did all these, like, trompe l'oeil paintings on the walls.
What's trompe l'oeil?
Well, it's like trick of the eye, meaning it's a French word for, like, in downtown Cincinnati, there's lots of trompe l'oeil murals on the sides of buildings.
Is that where the eyes follow you? Is that a trompe?
No, it's like, it looks like a real staircase.
Thank you for clarifying that. Okay. I didn't know that what that was.
Yeah, so I did, like, an entire little city in the walls, and under the stairs I did a little playhouse with a Dutch door that would open and a little mailbox and a picket fence. So, I mean, it was very cute. And
how long did you live there in that house before you came here? And did the kids able to enjoy it for a long time?
Oh, yeah. We lived there for 14 years, several years before the kids were born. And then, and so they were still little when we moved here. My daughter Carly was 8 and Kevin was 6.
Oh, okay. So you had plenty of time to enjoy. Did the next family that buy the house, were they going to keep that playroom?
Oh, yes. That's part of what sold the house, actually. They absolutely loved it. And, yeah, I really was. I mean, I did all of it myself. I mean, not all of it. I had a guy come in and at least put up some of the walls, and somebody laid the carpet and tile, of course. But everything else I painted, and I figured out the whole plan myself. And, you know, so it didn't cost a fortune. But it was a lot of fun.
Well, that's my mother, Ted, told me all about that.
Oh, that's nice.
And then she says to me one day, well, you know that girl who's got the nice basement? She goes, she's moving to Cincinnati.
Oh, that's right, because your mom worked in the pediatrician's office that I went to.
And then I remember your sister, Carrie Goldhoff, had a a party for you, like a thing. And I was, I don't know if I said it to you. I can't remember anymore. Like, why are you, why did you come here?
You did say that to me. I do remember that. That's right. Yes. My sister-in-law gave a party for me literally the next day the day after we moved to Cincinnati.
Yeah.
And it was actually lovely. I mean, one of the best ideas that she had was that everybody, she made a card that she had all of you guys fill out, everybody who was invited to the party. And it talked about all kinds of things. Like it asked you guys to fill out like your best kept secret in Cincinnati and the best places that you take your kids and all kinds of tips for, you know, living in Cincinnati. And then she sent all of them to me in advance.
Oh.
And so when I got to Cincinnati and I met all of you at the party, I was able to put a face with a card that I had read, and it was a great conversation starter and got lots of ideas for places to take the family. It was actually the most incredibly thoughtful, lovely.
Did mine offer you a plane ticket back?
I think you said if we're driving back to Chicago to visit our family that you hitch a ride.
So speaking of kids and families, we still have more Passover drawings that are in the centerfold of the Israelites and beautiful pictures, and amazing, amazing. And then there is this week, the dining out is a sugar and spice story again, but it's got a little bit of a twist. There's two women in the photograph, Carol Dragle and Polly Stein, who are actually interviewed. So that's he was there and they turned around, and also one of the Ovadia boys is in there, and he's also interviewed. So it's kind of Micah Ovadia. And so it's kind of fun that while Bob Wilhelmy was there interviewing, he found some Cincinnatians to chit-chat that actually come back and read the Israelites. So it's wonderful.
That's very nice. Also, I think the Sugar and Spice is now owned by Adam Mayerson. Speaking of things.
Speaking of connections.
Yeah.
You know, I love connections. I love serendipity and connections. And so we are up to page 18 on From the Pages. And I'm going to let you begin since Ted's not here. You know, Ted's off agitating the fish.
Well,
then he's going to come home. Then he's going to come home and we're going to have fish stories. I'm not going to be here next week, so I'm kind of relieved that I'm not going to be listening to one of his fish stories.
Well, it's like, I don't know. I don't get fishing and I don't get golfing. I really don't get either of those two things, but a lot of people absolutely love it, and Kinahora is what
I think. He tells me all the time, you know, I'm not killing the fish. He said I put them back. But then at the same time, he's also telling me that he catches fish and he brings them up. There's at the butcher up in Cleveland, he stops by and brings him some fish, and he promised Lenny from last week some fish. Oh, I also have to apologize from last week. I have to backtrack. I said that you were the daughter-in-law of the Dr. Sakes from Jewish Hospital, but you're the daughter-in-law from the Dr. Sakes from Dayton.
No.
No?
No, no. I am the niece of Eddie Sakes, who is one of the most wonderful, amazing human beings on the planet. Just love and adore him. My father-in-law, Sonny's father, Keith Sakes, was an attorney and a judge in Dayton, Ohio, but was his brother.
Okay.
And Sonny's dad, Keith, passed away when he was only 53 years old, and Uncle Eddie has been more like a father/father-in-law to us and grandparent to our children. He is a wonderful person and kind of took that role. So in a way, I'm proud to be called or considered his daughter-in-law.
We, of course, knew Eddie Sakes from Dr. Sakes from the minute we came to Cincinnati. But also, when I come to some of your events, you always have a Passover Seder you invite us to, or you have a Rosh Hashanah dinner, and the Sakes, you know, when they're in town, they always...
Oh, yeah.
I hope I'll see them in May.
Yes, hopefully, yes. And Aunt Karen, his wife. But I will tell a really quick story. When anytime someone hears that our last name is Sakes, that we've had the craziest stuff happen. Sonny was standing in line at a restaurant once, and they called Sakes, party of two or whatever. And they said, the guy next to Sonny said, your name's Sakes? Yeah, do you? And he says, you know Eddie Sakes? And he said, yeah, he's my uncle. The guy pulls up his shirt all the way up over almost his face and shows him the scar from like top to bottom. Your uncle did this! And Sonny's like, thank you? He's the doctor. I'm not. I'm really not interested in seeing your scars. But I've had that happen too, where many people have talked about their disgusting surgeries and gone into great detail because, I mean, I'm sure as the wife of a doctor, you get that all the time. But just by the fact that my last name is Sakes, I get to hear about all the medical yuckiness.
Yeah, they don't show us scars, but they do tell us that they were traumatized, like when he did a prostate exam or something.
Oh, sure, right. Love it. Okay.
Anyway, so from the beginning, please help us out here.
Okay, so it looks like the Israelite-ish. What is that ish?
That's the way that Sam Brewer wrote it.
But I wonder what, okay, anyway, I always wonder what that means. Okay, so apparently there's 5 Jewish burial grounds in Cincinnati, 3 of which are closed, which I don't know why. Well, they were full by 1854, who knows? Mm. So this guy, Benjamin Lape, died on which occasion? Jonas blah, 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 and this guy and that guy, who were founders of the first congregation in the city, purchased on North Longworth, 25 by 50 feet of ground, blah, blah, blah. You know, that's funny. I don't really even know what they're getting at with that, to be honest. But I know there was this whole thing with cemeteries and graveyards for Jewish.
How can we find out more information?
Well, you're setting me up. She's so funny. She's so transparent. My dad, Ron Richards, happens to be an expert in Jewish Cincinnati. And back in the day, there was a guy named Danny Ransahoff who was an expert, and Nancy Klein. My father sort of learned at their knee and, you know, did tours with them. And then he sort of took over doing tours of Jewish Cincinnati and knows a lot about the history of our community. I'd have to, he's got some stories about cemeteries, but I don't know. I'd probably have to, am I allowed to call him?
Yeah. Hold on. We're going to take a break and we're going to try and get hold of your dad. 1 minute.
All right. Let me see if he's home.
Hello?
Hey, it's Julie Brick, Mr. Richards. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
Very good. I'm going to put Pam on the phone and we're going to talk about the Jewish cemeteries.
Hi, Dad.
Okay.
How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Good. Thank you. I just saw you. But I told Julie we were talking about, there's something in the Israelite this week about the Jewish cemeteries from back in 1854, and it reminded me that you had some interesting stories and that you're an expert on Jewish Cincinnati and all that good stuff. And we just said, hey, maybe we'll just give him a call and he can tell the story that I heard for many, many years about the, I guess, well, anyway, the grave. Remember the guy that wanted to buy the land and they didn't want him to? Do you know which one I mean?
Yeah, this guy, the guy that we're talking about is a guy named Khan.
Okay.
And not related to the Khan meatpacking people, but Khan. In 1854, the Jews were just becoming, or not just the Jews, but the people around Cincinnati were moving out of the main core downtown, which is where everything was, up because they were able to have movement up into the hills along Ludlow Avenue and areas like that. And so what happened was he bought some property on what we call today Old Ludlow. And so after a couple of days, he was visited by some people who live in that particular area, and they told him they didn't want him living up there. They didn't want his kind up there. And so he made a comment to them, and he said, okay. He said, since you don't want live Jews, you'll live with dead Jews. And so he opened up a cemetery. And the cemetery, up until about 10 years ago, was still being used. And if you go to Old Ludlow, you'll find it's kind of embedded in the, it's still being, as I said, up to 10 years ago, at least I know it was being used for burials. But it's embedded into the kind of the side of the hill in such a manner that the houses above it are completely surrounding the cemetery. So that's exactly what he did. So he said, if you're not going to live with live Jews, you'll live with dead Jews. And that was, and in fact, it's interesting. It's one of the few really noted anti-Semitism in Cincinnati, because Cincinnati was fairly good about that kind of a thing, and there was very little anti-Semitism in Cincinnati until that particular issue.
Well, that's pretty interesting. Thank you for telling us that story, because Pam had mentioned it, and we thought, well, we should contact you and get the real story.
Yes, and my dad.
Well, there's. Oh, I don't know how much time you got, but there's also the other cemetery, which is the oldest cemetery, you know, west of the Alleghenies, and that's the one down on near Columbia, or not Columbia, near Central, rather, and Carter. And what it is the first cemetery. And what's interesting about that, Jewish cemetery, what's interesting about that, they had a cemetery before they had a synagogue of any kind in the city. So the guy named Lieb, they didn't know he was Jewish, and all of a sudden he asked to see some of the members of the Jewish community, which there were only about 10 or 12 people at that time that were Jewish, and they didn't know why he wanted to see them, and they went to see him, and they found out that he was Jewish, and he said, look, I'm dying. I want to be buried as a Jew. And so they didn't know what to do. They didn't have a synagogue yet. In fact, that was what formed the first community, basically. And Longworth, who was very wealthy, non-Jew, donated the land, and they had the first burial. And as I said, they had it before they had the synagogue. I mean, it's still there, and it's now under the Synagogue Association that's handling it.
Oh, the Greater Cincinnati
Greater Cincinnati Cemetery.
Yeah. Oh, that's whatever. So cool. Well, thank you for all that
info.
I mean, I think that Ted should probably have you on as a special guest to talk about all the things you know about the Jewish
and church. Baseball.
That's
and
right.
Also baseball.
Yeah, right. Well, basically, Danny Rantahall was the one that got me started on this. And and I did some tours after going on one of his tours. And at that time, I was doing tours of Cincinnati in general as an avocation. And then I went on one of his Jewish tours. And I was so impressed that I kind of talked to him about it. And then I started doing some. And then, of course, he passed away not too long after that. But
I mentioned that.
He's the one that inspired that whole idea.
Well, and you're a wealth of information and have given a lot of amazing tours over the many
decades. When we get to our next travel one, I'm going to have Ted call you. So we really appreciate this. Thank you.
Yes.
We hope we didn't interrupt anything going on in your afternoon on this rainy
day.
No,
that was fine. I was just reading. So
okay.
That's fine.
Well, thank you very, very much, and I'll talk to you soon, I'm sure.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye. Thanks, Dad.
Well, that's pretty interesting, you know. We're going to have him on the travel because he'll give us a tour of Cincinnati, Jewish Cincinnati.
Oh, my God. Growing up with this, that's all I heard morning, noon, and night is, did you know?
That's cute. 125 years ago, the ladies' column talks about cleaning her hat, and you had some commentary on that.
You'll have to read it, but she talks about how to clean your dusty straw hat. Like, it's as far as I'm concerned, I'd kind of, like, blow on it and, you know, that call it a day, but okay. She wants you to like mix up some sugar and water and rub it on the hat and leave it out to dry. And I'm thinking, you know, if you put sugar all over your hat, you might not have dust, but are you going to have bugs and crawly things all over you? With, you know, I remember at Camp Livingston, one of the pranks that we did to one of the boy counselors was we poured sugar in his shoes in the cabin, not the ones he was wearing, but when everybody was at the, Hadar, the dining hall, eating dinner, we snuck in and poured packs of sugar in all of his shoes.
Oh.
And I'm telling you, it didn't take more than 15 minutes for there to be like millions of ants and bugs. And that was so mean. Anyway, hopefully he's gotten over it since then. But then he got me back by putting frogs in my bed. And that was, yeah. So anyway.
Whoa. Well, obviously, you don't have the good behavior that we read about in the children's corner.
That's right.
So the children's corner talks about some children being quiet in their play to let a sick woman rest in peace. I mean, I don't know if that rest in peace kind of reminds you that she's dead, but this rest in peace. And you also had a commentary on that saying that you thought that this was trying to say that because they were Jewish, they had the good behavior too.
Well, I think she was making the comment that the one kid who said basically, you know, get away. The girl comes down and says, my mother's sick and you guys are making too much noise and she's really sick and it's disturbing her. And the one boy says, yeah, great. So we're going to go over to the next neighborhood and that woman's going to be sick and we're never going to get to play because everyone's going to think we're disturbing them. So forget you. We're going to stay here. And then the other boy says, no, we're going to go away and we're going to be quiet out of respect to your mother. And so the woman who writes the ladies' column is basically saying that must – alluding to the fact that the one who did the quote-unquote right thing, of course it was because of his good Jewish values, that he was the Jewish one, and he did the right thing, and then maybe alluding to that the other kids maybe who didn't want to be quiet.
She says, the nephews of the corner are such boys that they are, for they have home training, and their religion teaches them to be regardful, for the rights of others.
Right. So that's what she was saying. I have a, you know, it's obvious that she was saying, oh, it's because he was a nice Jewish boy and he did the right thing. So
50 years ago, Jewish hospitals' births include Rabbi and Mrs. Donald Spolansky. Greta Lorge of 2663 Vera Avenue announced the birth of a daughter, Yael Sabbath. Thursday, April 1st, the infant has a sister, Karen Albee. So I want to first apologize. There's a typo in the paper, which we will correct next week. They spelled Yael wrong. But I'd also like to tell everyone that we're going to take a break here, and when we come back, Pam and I are going to be on an interview with Rabbi Spolansky, who is the senior rabbi at Holy Blossom in Toronto, Canada. Very exciting. Hello, everyone. We have Rabbi Yael Spolansky from Congregation Holy Blossom in Canada. So we're having a visit from our friends in Canada, the suburb of the United States. And we're so happy and honored to have Rabbi Spolansky with us. She actually was born in Cincinnati, which is the reason for our call. As you know, on page 18, our From the Pages section, we highlight different things, and our assistant editor, Carol Hershenson, picked out Rabbi Spolansky's birth. And I'm going to read it to you, and I'm also going to apologize in advance because there is a typo in there, which we will correct. And it says, Jewish hospital births include Rabbi and Mrs. Donald Spolansky. Her maiden name was Greta Lorge, and I want everyone to know she was related to the Bernsteins. It's Miriam Bernstein's sister. Of 2663 Vera Avenue announced the birth of a daughter, Yael Sabbath. Thursday, April 1st, the infant had a sister, Karen Albee. So tell us, Rabbi Spolansky, just tell us, what do you remember from that birth?
Well, I know it was April Fool's Day, which has always been a fun way to celebrate. I do want to correct just one thing you said, which is my mother, Greta Lee, is the niece of Miriam Bernstein.
Okay.
So Miriam and my grandmother, Eudice Lorge, of blessed memory, they were sisters.
Okay.
So Miriam is my great aunt.
And she wonderful. Was, yeah. And I remember Rabbi Lorge growing up and going to camp too. So you come from a long line of rabbis. You are the first fourth generation rabbi in the whole world, reform rabbi in the whole world. And I know Pam joins me in just being amazed at what you have done for womanhood and the rabbinate and everything. And, you know, you were born here. How long did you live in Cincinnati?
So I'm happy to tell you about my deep Cincinnati roots because I'm very proud that I'm a Cincinnati girl. But I'll start with, you know, the latest chapter of the story of my generation. So yes, I was born there, and we lived there until 1984 when my father took a position with a synagogue in the Boston area. And it was just the summer after my bat mitzvah at Temple Sholem in Cincinnati. And I was brokenhearted to leave. I had just had one amazing year at Walnut Hills High School, and I loved it, and I had new friends, and my whole world was opening up. I graduated from Yavna Day School. I love that too, and still to this day have good friends from Yavna, now Rockwern Academy, of course. So that's when we left. My first 13 years, and although I think of Toronto as home, I think of Boston as home, I think of Jerusalem as home, I certainly also think of Cincinnati as home. And whenever I have a chance to go back to be with cousins or to study at Hebrew Union College, I always jump at the chance to return. And it always feels like a homecoming.
And from you, so you moved then, and then college, and then you went to HUC. So you tell us a little bit about that, and you made a return back to Cincinnati.
Right. So in those days, HUC would ask the students while we were in Jerusalem for our first of the 5 years, where would you like to go from here? Which of the three stateside campuses, Cincinnati, the original campus, New York City, or Los Angeles? And we were able to rank them in order of priority. And nowadays, the Cincinnati campus is very popular among students. But in my time, people wanted to go to one of the bigger cities on the coasts. And I was one of the students who ranked Cincinnati as my first choice. And so I was happy to return there. And one of the benefits, I have to say, as a student in Cincinnati is that we really, while we were working many internships, teaching, and traveling to small congregations in the Midwest and in the South and in the West that were not able to have a full-time rabbi of their own, we had a lot of, you know, extracurricular responsibilities, to be sure. But our studies were able to be first and foremost, and we were afforded time to spend in the library and with homework. I remember my class in New York were hardly ever given homework because they had to work so many jobs just to pay the rent. So I was really pleased to return to Cincinnati and, of course, to be with family, as you said. And my boyfriend then, who is now my husband, was going to grad school at Indiana University in Bloomington, just a couple hours away. So that was also a draw.
That's what, yeah, and you went to Indiana for your undergraduate, correct? Okay. And what did you study at Indiana?
I studied anthropology, and I also was the first of two people to graduate with a double major, the second major being in Jewish studies. That was the first year that they awarded a full major in Jewish studies. So I had spent my third year of university at Hebrew U in Jerusalem and picked up many Jewish studies courses there. And I also enjoyed the faculty of Jewish studies at IU before and after that year. So I thought I was just going for a certificate in Jewish studies. That's what they had been granting up until that point. But my year, they gave a Jewish studies major to me and to one other student who also went on to become a rabbi, a conservative rabbi.
That's interesting because although Ted, the publisher of the newspaper, doesn't like when I put it in personal stories, but I have to tell you, my husband went to Indiana and he majored in biology and he, I guess, minored or whatever certificate in Jewish study because he was deciding whether to go to medical school or rabbinical school. So that's very funny. He speaks very highly of the Jewish education at Indiana University. In the meantime, you have your husband is a poet and a professor up in Canada. You married your boyfriend and he's a well-known poet and professor. His name is Dr. Adam Saul, correct? Am I pronouncing it right?
Yes, that's right.
And how many children now do you have?
We have three boys. They are so much fun. And even in lockdown during this pandemic, it's just been delightful to have this time all together under one roof.
It is. And so about Cincinnati, tell us, what's your favorite Cincinnati thing, your favorite food in Cincinnati, and maybe your favorite Jewish thing?
Okay, well, certainly Grater's ice cream. That's a must.
That's a given.
A given. And, you know, I can tell you, my first winter here, Adam's birthday is Christmas Day, and I wanted to surprise him with Grater's, and it turns out that you cannot order it over the border. They don't ship it over the border.
Contraband.
Yeah, I think the dairy farmers in Canada have some front about that. So
can you smuggle it in now through the border? Can you smuggle it in if you're driving?
I don't know. I haven't tried that. I don't know.
So what did you end up doing since you couldn't get the Grater's?
I don't even remember. It wasn't memorable, whatever we did. Yeah.
And tell us, what's it like living in Canada? So you went from HUC to Holy Blossom. And tell us, what's it like? What did you find immediately different when you got to Canada?
Yes. So Rabbi Dov Marmer was the senior rabbi at the time. And he really is one of the giants of his generation. And I knew I wanted to be in a big, busy, ambitious place, and I wanted to learn from the best. So I was thrilled to be able to come to Toronto. And it's a great city. We thought we were going to be here for maybe, you know, 3 or 5 years as my first gig, my first position, and then move back to the States. But it's the kind of city and it's the kind of congregation that really gets a hold of you. And then, of course, so much of America has changed over these 21 years since we've been here. And so we've grown to really not only love the city, but to be very proud to live in this country, to raise our sons here. We're all dual citizens. And I will say Canada is not the northern suburb of America. It's very much its own country with its own. And I have to appreciate that. It is, the differences are subtle. You have to learn how to see them, hear them, but they are significant.
So Rabbi, not only did you go to Indiana and HUC, but you also have a certificate from Northwestern in management of clergy, and you are a rabbinic fellow of the Shalom Hartman Institute of Jerusalem, and you have an extensive resume. Would you like to just give us a little bit, just a small amount of background? You're so published, and you have these videos. I've looked at some of your videos, and just a quick background on your full resume.
Sure. Maybe I'll speak about the Hartman Institute because I'm really enjoying my studies there very much. I'm part of what was intended to be a 3-year fellowship. And now because of the pandemic, it's been stretched to a 4-year fellowship. And it's intensive learning with the faculty of the Hartman Institute in Jerusalem and North America. And we spend a lot of time in Jerusalem. I'm really still hoping that I'll be able to make my way there this summer. And what I love about it is not only the rigor of Jewish thought and taking relevant, urgent questions of the day and mining old wisdom for guidance, but also the pluralistic approach. The Hartman Institute is very serious about Jewish pluralism. And while I am absolutely a product of the Reform Movement, a leader of the Reform Movement, I just finished a term sitting on the CCAR board. I just received an invitation to be from HUC to be a mentor to rabbinical students. I sit on the President's Council for Dr. Rehfeld at HUC. I am fully entrenched in the Reform Movement and proud to be so. And I believe that the work of Jewish pluralism and building bridges and understanding among us is essential work right now. And I think we've seen the worst of what denominationalism can do. And now I feel that over the last 10, 15 years or so, the standard is that there should be mutual respect and greater understanding. And that's a shift that I embrace and I want to be a part of.
Pam, do you have any questions you'd like to? We also have Pam Sakes on with us. As I mentioned, she's the author of I Dare You, about Jewish engagement. And she's a professional in the Jewish community for community and Jewish engagement. Pam, do you have any questions for Rabbi Splansky before we hit the birthday?
You know, what do you find is your biggest challenge as it relates? I mean, especially during the pandemic, I know that, you know, that has posed some unique challenges, of course, but just overall, in terms of engagement with Jewish life, with your congregation, what do you feel is like your biggest challenge with that?
Well, I will say the pandemic has... in all areas of life, I think it's exposed some cracks in the systems, all the systems. Mm-hmm. And that's also true in synagogue life. I think the membership model that we had for synagogues was already under the microscope, already under time of experimentation. We at Holy Blossom Temple have experimented with different models, one very successful way of bringing young families to join us. But we've been moving, you know, steadily and slowly, cautiously, I would say, in asking those big questions again. And now with the pandemic, I think synagogues across North America are really shaken up to say there, this is not a subtle change, this is a significant change. And to be honest, I don't know how it's going to play out. I think it's going to be another 5 years before we have a sense of really where we're going with the membership models for synagogues, but it is changing. So when, I'm sure it's true for the Cincinnati synagogues as well, if they have online learning and online services, I'm sure they're finding, as we are, that hundreds of people are joining us from far off places. And on the one hand, it's very exciting and very flattering. You know, who's in Singapore that wants to join us in Toronto? What's that about, you know? But eventually we have to figure out what is the funding model for synagogues. And if everything is open, how do we keep our doors open? And how do we keep the heat on? So that's not so rabbinic, I would say. That's more, you know, wearing an executive hat. But, you know, the things they did not teach us in rabbinical school have come to take significant time this year.
So well, I will say I've had conversations with HUC, and fortunately, I don't think they were interested in this idea. But whether it's me or anybody else who's an expert in Jewish engagement, I believe it's something they need to actually teach the rabbinic students. It's something that really, you know, you can learn Talmud and you can learn Torah and you can learn all the history and everything else. But many rabbis these days are expected to come in and be the everything, you know, make sure that they're coming up with the programming. I mean, especially in the smaller congregations, and it's hurting them because they don't come in necessarily prepared or having, you know, been able to think a lot about that while they're in school, but it's a huge piece, you know, and it's getting bigger every day and every, you know, with every situation that comes up. So I'm sure it'll continue to be a challenge. And I do wish that some of the, you know, like HUC and other institutions that are training our future rabbis would think more seriously about it, sort of, you know, at that sort of systemic level, as opposed to sort of putting out a fire later or having to learn as they go. It was just, you know, something that I'm a proponent of, but I'm kind of stand there alone at this point.
Well, my impression is that the curriculum has grown significantly in that direction since my time. Mm-hmm. So I think there has been a lot of attention paid with the more practical sides of the congregational rabbinate. But in my day, at least on the Cincinnati campus, there was very little of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I know for myself personally that I look forward to going back and being with people. Like I used to, you get these invitations for mitzvah, weddings, and I mean, we've had so many weddings in the last few years, like all three of my kids got married in the same year. And then we had all of our friends' kids were getting married. It was just crazy. I mean, like every invitation is like, oh, now I cannot wait to get an invitation to go somewhere. Pam's son is getting married. I cannot wait to get dressed up. I cannot wait to go to services all dressed up, nice, cleaned up. I just can't wait. It, being in a building, being, you know, somewhere where I can see people, smell people, you know, actually see them up close. I can't wait. Awesome. So, okay. So we are actually here because it is your 50th birthday and you had this great video. I was able to watch it about your birthday, but tell everyone, how did you celebrate your 50th birthday?
Okay. Well, I love birthdays and the older I get, the more I love them. So thanks to COVID, there was no travel with my husband to some romantic destination, and there was no birthday dinner with my kids and my friends at some terrific restaurant. And it was Pesach, so there was no delicious fluffy cake either. So what did we do? My husband surprised me with a video filled with messages, video messages from friends and family. Aww. And it was like an hour and a half long. So all morning, I just sat there with the coffee that he brought me. And for a few moments, I was in the good company of each one of them. And that was just perfect, perfect, perfect. It was as if, you know, all my favorite people were in one room. So what else? People dropped by flowers. People dropped by some home spa treatments. And I did a couple of those. I went for a walk.
And what was your dessert? What was your dessert?
So we did have a nice family dinner that my husband made for us. And my oldest son, Avishai, made a flourless chocolate cake, which was really delicious. And then another surprise came with a Zoom call with about 10 of my best friends from years and years ago, from Hebrew University, from Indiana University, from Cincinnati, from my regional youth group when I was in the Boston area. So that was just such a treat because I'm working so hard. I really don't make enough time for maintaining those friendships, even though whenever we do see each other, we pick up right where we left off and it's so natural. I miss them. I miss them terribly. So that was a great way to end the day. And then the grand finale, it was, 11 o'clock and we're watching Shtisel. Everyone's watching
Shtisel. Oh, I love Shtisel.
Right. And a friend sent us a text saying, you won't believe it, but for your neighborhood, they're opening vaccine appointments for 50 plus. So we went as we're watching Shtisel, we took the other laptop and checked and the registration form wasn't up. And I kept hitting refresh, 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 refresh. And at 10 minutes to midnight, I'm not joking, 10 minutes to midnight, my birthday is ending. I just turned 50. Ta-da! The registration opens up. And we were like first in line. So we got our first pick of appointments. We set it up for that weekend, which is now last weekend. And we got our vaccines, our first dose.
Is that not amazing? Would you not say that's beshert? That's like amazing. That's amazing. That's wonderful. And I don't want to go into it because I'd like people to follow you on YouTube and see your birthday video. You had a lot of discussion about Yam and Adama, the sea, and Yam and Adama, the land. And I'd like everyone to catch that and follow you because I thought it was a really touching video. And it's wonderful that you're inoculated and it's just the beginning and you want to go up to people and say, oh my God, I'm inoculated. You're so excited and you're so proud and you feel this new burst of energy and with spring. And so that's so wonderful. And mazel tov on your birthday, mazel tov on your inoculation. Is there anything that you did or splurged on or had decadence during COVID that you want to share with us? Just something, you know, just a little something.
Well, during Pesach, I decided I could eat anything I want. So that flourless chocolate cake was delicious. And now I'm back on the Peloton.
Yeah. And what is the first thing you're going to do when COVID is officially over?
Well, certainly to see family. That's I miss being with my parents, my sister, my brother, and all their kids. So that's the first priority for sure.
Well, we want to wish you a mazel tov on your 50th birthday. And it was the saying goes, may you live to be 120. Is that the saying? And every year, better and better, healthier, healthier, happier, happier, more success, and the same for your family. And this has been quite an honor. On behalf of Pam and I and the American Israelite and the Let There Be Light podcast, this has been quite an honor to have this time with you. And we really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so very much. I do wonder if we could take just one more moment. And if it's out of turn, you'll figure out how to edit it. But because we're talking about Cincinnati, I do want to honor my Cincinnati roots and just share a few of the stories of the generation past. Today is Yom HaShoah, which makes me think very much about my grandfather who fled Nazi Germany and was a hero of the American army, helped to liberate Buchenwald. So if I could, do you have another moment?
We can talk about it. Yes.
Okay. So my great grandparents, Susan and Albert Goldman, came from New York to Cincinnati for two reasons. One, they were looking for a place where they could open a business, and they did open a furniture store that ran for decades in Cincinnati. And they also were looking for a place with a labor Zionist circle. They wanted to be part of an active Zionist circle. And they found that in Cincinnati, Ohio. So that's what began the Cincinnati line in my family. And my grandmother, Yudis Lorge, Aleha Shalom, she grew up in Habonim and the labor Zionist circles and going door to door in Cincinnati with the blue box of JNF.
Yes.
And many people in Cincinnati, many of your listeners will remember her sister, Miriam Bernstein, who
is
also a very important figure in my life. And she helped, actually the great grandparents were among the founders of the Talmud Torah, which then became Yavne Day School, which then became the Rockburn Academy. And my Aunt Miriam was so devoted to Yavne's growing success, really poured so many loving hours of volunteering and fundraising and building community there. And then my grandmother, both of them dated a lot of HUC students. The Cincinnati girls would date the HUC boys. And my Aunt Miriam said that she dated them to make sure that they were Zionists. At that time, it was not built in necessarily that a Reform rabbinical student would be a Zionist. So that was her mission. My grandmother found a great Zionist in a rabbinical student named Ernst Lorge, Alav HaShalom. So my grandfather Ernst really was rescued by Hebrew Union College. He was a family friend of Rabbi Leo Beck in Germany. My great grandfather was a Reform rabbi and a classmate of Beck. And when my grandfather wanted to make Aliyah to volunteer for the Navy of Palestine, which we joke had, you know, two canoes and a tugboat at the time, his mother burst into tears, and she was a very strong German woman, and he had never seen her cry before. She begged him not to go, and they sent him to Rabbi Beck to give him guidance, and Beck sent him to Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati. He came on a one-way ticket on the Queen Mary. That was 1936. And in fact, Morgenstern, who was the president at the time, said, I have a lot of German students on my hands. Give me a little time, go across the street, go to University of Cincinnati, and the Jewish fraternity there will put you up and you can take some classes, work on your English, and then come back to HUC. So that's what he did. And the day after he was ordained, he and my grandmother were married at the chapel at HUC. And it wasn't long after that he put on the American chaplain's uniform and went back to Europe and was part of the liberation effort there and part of, stayed a long time after to help the DPs to reunite with one another and to find their way back into the world, back to life again. So those are some of my stories of my deeper roots in Cincinnati. And whenever I'm with people who can appreciate those stories, I like to share them because it's, I know where I come from, and I'm grateful for the leadership of each of those generations. They absolutely shape me in every way, including the leadership that I bring to my synagogue today. And one generation forward, if I can take one more moment of your time, my own parents. So they both grew up in Chicago, and they know all about Olentzer Ruby, which my grandfather helped to found. And that's where they met. And while my father is ordained from HUC in New York, he wanted to earn a PhD in Jewish studies. And so he was given an opportunity to do that at the Cincinnati campus while being an assistant rabbi at Rockdale Temple. And he was a part of the transition from when that congregation moved from Rockdale Avenue to Amberley. That was quite a contentious time. Maybe some of your listeners will remember. The civil rights movement was raging, and he was a brand new rabbi, but had an opportunity to lead the congregation through that very emotional transition. And then he became the solo rabbi at Temple Sholem to follow Rabbi Brav. And it took him 11 years being a full-time congregational rabbi and working slowly and steadily on his PhD and his dissertation. So from each one of those figures, I have these tremendous models of Jewish scholarship and Jewish courage, love of Israel. And certainly Cincinnati and Hebrew Union College are running threads through our family story. So thank you for giving me an opportunity to share some of those memories.
Wow. I mean, you have such a rich, you know, history here and in our city. And it's so impressive. I have to say that Miriam Bernstein is such an amazing, I don't know, role model for many of us. I bet, Julie, you could probably
chime in with that as well. Yeah.
Just remember her when my son went to Yavna. She was always there in the gift shop, you know, running here, running there, getting us all involved. Just such a force and an amazing personality. I mean, I just adored her beyond belief, and her kids, all of them amazing. You know, Ellen, may she rest in peace, was so lovely. And her daughter, Sarah, when my son was at AEPI at University of Cincinnati, they have their philanthropy happens to be breast cancer. And they work with the Jewish breast cancer. I forget the name of it. It starts with a shin. You know, which is amazing for a bunch of fraternity guys to make that their philanthropy.
I remember that event. It was beautiful.
They were looking, you know, to do a fundraiser. And I said to my son, you know, what would be amazing is I don't think that Sarah Ganson has ever told her story, you know, from the perspective of a child, you know. And so we ended up having the most beautiful dinner at the JCC. I think 400 people came and you guys were there. And Sarah got up. There wasn't a dry eye in the house, just, you know, this beautiful memorial, you know, to her mother, you know, honoring the family. And we were just so proud and honored to be able to do something like that. So the community could really get a sense. And they actually won a national AEPI award at the Waldorf Astoria at their, I think, 100th year anniversary, where people from all over the world who were involved in AEPI came. They won first place award for that event. So anyway, a wonderful, amazing family who continue to, you know, do such great things in our community. So.
And the other thing I want to add is that Rabbi, your generation of different rabbis, we've heard this story about HUC saving these young boys from Germany. Also from, we interviewed the Svat family on Rabbi, or Doctor, he was Dr. Matayahu Svat. So this is a recurring theme. And it's, I mean, I always am amazed at the serendipity of these conversations I have with people from the interviews. Today is Yom HaShoah. There's so much intertwined, so much beshared. I'm always fascinated and in love with all these stories and how we all are interwoven and we are all one and all part of each other. So again, this has been quite an honor. And we want to thank you so much, Rabbi Splansky, for your time today. You. And a happy birthday. Mazel tov on your 50th.
Thank you.
Many more.
Really. And we sign off from Let There Be Light podcast. Thank you again. Bye-bye, Rabbi.
Welcome back. That was a great interview with Rabbi Splansky, and I was really touched by her stories of Cincinnati. I didn't expect some of those extra stories, and I felt really touched by them and the connections that she still has with Cincinnati.
And also, it was just really interesting to know how much, you know, you wouldn't have realized that HUC played a role in saving people's lives during the Holocaust. And, you know,
we had heard that actually from Matayahu Svat was one of the people that also came over, in that they had a class of rabbis that were all saved. And it's amazing and a wonder. And look what we did with the people that we saved. So you go back, and of course, the thought is all those people that were murdered, what could have been in that mixture? What did we lose? But we also gained from those people that were saved. Thank it's God, amazing. Yeah. Next, we're going to move on to Foodie Fun Kosher, our food columnist, Gail Levine Schindler. And I think we're going to give her a call because we'd like to find out what's going on in her life right now. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be on the phone with Gail Schindler.
Hello.
Hi, Gail. It's Julie Brooke from the Let There Be Light podcast from the American Israelite, and I have with me Pam Richard-Sakes, who is my guest host today.
Hello, Julie and Pam.
Hello.
Well, we just got to your wonderful column this week where you talk about community-supported agriculture, which I think is very cool. And I want people to read the article so they can understand about this sharing of produce and also the idea that you could take produce that is imperfect, have it shipped to you, and how you were creative enough to use it. But we were kind of curious. What are you making for dinner tonight, Gail?
Haha. So first I'll say, you know, there's a difference between the community supported agriculture and the imperfect food. So just to be clear, but again, read the article to find out the difference. What am I making for dinner tonight? I am making an Asian sort of inspired chicken broth bowl.
Wow. Mm. And what kind of what vegetables will be in that tonight? And where did you get your vegetables?
Okay, so the vegetables that will be in it tonight, some of them came from my perfectly imperfect box. And in fact, I'm getting another box tomorrow. I get a box every 2 weeks. So actually, a couple of days ago in the middle of the week, I sort of ran a little dry on some vegetables. And I ended up with a very uniformly colored meal, which was not really pretty, but it was kind of all I had. So I have some vegetables that came in the box, peppers, onions, the ginger that I'm going to use came in the box. And I did have to pick up a couple of things at the store because I was just really out of everything. So I bought mushrooms and asparagus. I have edamame, which is frozen, celery, which came in the box, and carrots, which came in the box. So pretty much everything that's in the fridge is going into the bowl.
So on your ginger, you actually buy a piece of ginger and you shred it? Because I always buy it in a jar. It comes with some, you know, it's like in a jar. I buy it off the cone.
You have to get it fresh.
Yeah, I don't know. How do you do that?
I do usually buy it whole. But, you know, like I said, these pieces came in my box. So I have three kind of big pieces of ginger. And there's a couple of ways to manage them. You know, they keep for a very long time. They have a very, very thin skin, which depending on what you're doing with them, you may or may not have to peel. So if you're grating ginger and you want it to be really fine and kind of disappear into the meal, you can just wash the root off and just grate it on a little, like a microplane, a very fine grater, with the skin, and you know, the skin will just sort of disappear into it, and you will never know that it's there.
And can I?
If you're,
go ahead.
Yep.
I was just going to say I have a trick because I use ginger a lot. I just take a spoon, and I just use the tip of the spoon, and it scrapes right off.
Right. You can just scrape it off with the edge of a spoon. You don't really need to peel it because, you know, a ginger root is not so big like a carrot. When you start peeling a ginger root, you peel away a lot of the ginger itself. But like I said, if you're grating it really fine, you don't really need to remove that thin skin. If you're slicing it or having it in slivers in a way where you're going to see the pieces, you can, like you said, use a spoon to remove it. One of the things that I do for people who don't use ginger really often, you can freeze it. I just take a big ginger root, wash it off, dry it off, and put it in the freezer. And then when I need it, I just take it out and grate it, skin and all, frozen.
Wow. Yeah, and speaking of frozen,
just put it back.
Yes.
And just put it back in the freezer.
Yeah, well, speaking of frozen, you know, as I've mentioned when you were our guest and also before, that I am now collecting those ends of the vegetables that I would normally put in my compost pile. I'm putting them in the freezer to make a vegetable stock for soup. I do have a question. It says not to use potatoes. Can you tell me why I shouldn't use potatoes?
The potato skins just make it really muddy.
Okay. Muddy color or muddy tasting?
Both.
Okay.
Both. So yeah, they're just a little heavy and they're a little dirty, even if you wash them, but they just muddy it up and you want the broth to be nice and clear.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. Cause I wasn't sure why we weren't supposed to use potatoes. And then in terms, I'm going to make sure I pronounce it right. The Yom holiday coming up, all the Yoms. Can you give us just something unusual that we that people don't think about to make for Israeli food that we could find interesting?
So, I mean, everybody, today is Yom HaShoah, which is a Holocaust Memorial Day. There are really no food traditions associated with it. But next week, the 15th, is Yom HaAtzmaut. So Yom HaZikaron begins Tuesday, the 13th of this month, and goes until sunset the 14th. And then sunset the 14th begins Yom HaAtzmaut. Yom HaZikaron is Israeli Memorial Day, like our Memorial Day. It's meant to commemorate and remember fallen soldiers. And in here in the States, we go shopping and have picnics and parades. In Israel, it's a very solemn holiday because there is really unlikely any family in Israel that hasn't had a loss somewhere in their history or an injury somewhere in their history of somebody in the family in the military. So it's a very serious holiday, and there's at least one, maybe two times during the day where the entire city stops. Yeah, the entire country stops. Mm-hmm. And the horns blare, and if you can see these videos on YouTube quite often.
I was there in Israel one year when it happened, yeah.
Right, and you see it even on the highway.
On the highway, we got out of the car and we stood up on the street. We got out of the car.
Right, so it's a very solemn holiday. And as soon as it's over at sunset, I mean, it's not the kind of holiday where you light candles or would say Havdalah, but right at that point where you would say Havdalah, it immediately goes from that somber, serious, tragic, sad holiday to Yom HaAtzmaut, which is a very fun, positive, boisterous celebration of the birth of the State of Israel. And in Israel, it is, you know, celebrated everywhere with fireworks and parades and picnics and concerts and parties. And so here in the States, before COVID, remember back before COVID, yeah, when we used to have festivals, federations and JCCs will often sponsor Yom HaAtzmaut, and synagogues and day schools will sponsor Yom HaAtzmaut festivals where you go and there's games for the kids. And they almost always serve falafel, which is kind of everybody's obvious go-to for Israeli food. And I love a good falafel, but this year I've come to really love something called Sabich, S-A-B-I-C-H with the ch. And it's a very popular food in Israel. It's largely eaten for breakfast. And it's a lightly fried eggplant with hard-boiled eggs and hummus and amba, which is a very tart pickle, pickled mango spread. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I've done, so I'm going to probably make sabich. I actually have an eggplant from my last box, so I probably will use that. And one of the things I've also started doing since I moved back here to Cincinnati is I learned to make pita, because I just can't get a good pita here. Sorry, Cincinnati, but it's true. And so I've had to learn how to make it. And I'm, you know, Julie, I'm not really a baker. Mm-hmm. It took a lot of fits and starts to figure out how to make it. But I bought a really big pizza stone, baking stone that covers the whole bottom of my oven. And I actually bought a giant pizza paddle for getting the pizza in and out of the oven.
Uh-huh.
And now great. I've kind of got it down to a science. I make about a dozen pizza at a time, so I will definitely be making fresh pizza for Yom HaAtzmaut.
And again, I'm going to be inviting myself over to your house when things are safe. and we really, really appreciate this. I'm going to look up that new dish that they're eating in Israel and try it for myself. And we really appreciate your time, Gail. This has been wonderful.
My pleasure. In regards to you, Pam, nice to meet you again. We know each other going all the way back to BBG. From Finneytown and Shalom BBG in the Roselawn area.
I thought you looked familiar.
Yeah, we're going to go out for lunch when this is all over. God. We are going to meet for lunch. We're going to have a good time, the three of us.
Yes.
And we're going to talk about Ted.
Well, that's a given.
In any event, thank you very, very much for your time.
My
and
pleasure.
We'll be in touch.
All
good
right. Have a great evening and a great weekend.
You
Shabbat
too.
Shalom.
Shabbat
Same
Shalom. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So, well, we're wrapping up now, and we are on page 22 of the obituaries. There's a large obituary about Rabbi Robert Marks, who was a big social justice pioneer. I'd like everyone to take a moment and read his obituary. Also this week, we lost Helen Jacobs, age 92, April 4th, 2021, 22nd of Nisan, 5781. And Lois Klein Jolson, age 84, March 31st, 2021, the 18th of Nisan, 5781.
John Mark Besson, age 72, March 27th, 2021, 14th Nisan, 5781.
May all their memories be for a blessing. And the last page, I don't think there's what's going on the last page. We'll have to take a quick look. Oh, just some advertisements and talking about the annual meeting from the Jewish Federation of Cincinnati. In any event, Pam, it has been a delightful.
Wait, no, you can't say goodbye yet. I'm sorry. Even though Ted's not here, we have to do the joke of the week.
Oh.
I'm going to give a joke of the week.
Okay, you give the joke of the week.
Yeah, because sometimes I'm wondering about these jokes of the week, Ted.
Well, I saw this one and it was so long, there was like no way. Hey, and if Ted was here reading it, I would have been like grabbing the table going, over, over, over.
Okay, so this one's short and sweet. I'm sure I'm not going to tell it well, but it's something like this. So a Jewish mother is at the beach they're playing around on the shore, and all of a sudden a big wave comes up and takes her little boy out to sea, and she's screaming, oh my God, you know, dear Lord, please, you know, send him back. I'll do anything. Please make him safe. Send him back. And she's crying and praying, and all of a sudden the big, huge wave, you know, comes in, rushes to shore, and in the wave, her son washes up. And he's fine and everything's great. And she's hugging her little boy and she looks up at the sky and she goes, excuse me, but he had a hat. That's really, really stupid, but it's so true.
Yeah. We're never quite 100% satisfied, are we?
Exactly right. Exactly.
Well, this has been a delight. It's really been a lot of fun. We interviewed a lot of people today. We had three interviews today. It was a lot of fun.
That's right.
And
yeah.
A lot of jokes. And I'm going to miss everyone next week. I don't believe I'm going to be on. I'm going to be out of town, but unless Ted calls me, which would be pretty funny. In any event, I want to wish everyone a Shavua Tov for a couple of weeks till I return. And thank you again, Pam. It's really been a pleasure and a lot of fun, as always, to be with you.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it. And, hope I would be happy to do it anytime. So
I hope we see you again very, very soon.
Too.
And thank you to Melissa House, who does our production of this. We really appreciate it. And to all the people at The Israelite, Carol Hershenson and Yossi and everyone who works at The Israelite who helps us get this together. So thank you very much. Great. Shavua Tov. Shavua Bye-bye. Tov.